Our next speaker is Fred Foldberry. Fred is Associate Professor of Economics and a member of the Civil Society Institute at Santa Clara University. He received his PhD from George Mason University. He's also Senior Editor of Progress Report, an online journal. His books include The Soul of Liberty, Beyond Neoclassical Economics, Public Goods and Private Communities, The Half-Life of Policy Formations with Dan Klein, who's also going to be speaking shortly. He's a contributing author to The Voluntary City. Dr. Foldberry is also the recipient of the Anthony Fisher International Memorial Award and the Community Associations Institute Research Foundation's Award of Excellence. I'm delighted to introduce Fred Foldberry.
Good evening. The question we're confronting today is, why is the state of California, and in particular, why are our cities in such a fiscal mess? And why has the gargantuan amount of government spending not solved our urban problems? Is it just incompetent and greedy politicians in an otherwise sound system of fiscal finance? Or could it be that the very structure of California's public finance is inherently dysfunctional? My argument here is that not just the system of taxing and spending, but the whole structure of government in California and the rest of the country, indeed of the whole world, has inherent dysfunctions. Patching it up can help, but this can't cure the problems. To do that, our political institutions have to be fundamentally restructured. What's wrong? There are three basic dimensions to the problem. First, ethics. Many people accept the current system because they themselves are petty tyrants. They think their values are better than those of others. They think their beliefs are more correct than those of others. They are supremacists who put their views above those of others, and indeed above that of liberty. And this creates social conflict and economic problems. So we'll continue to have problems such as crime and poverty until society learns to recognize the ethical principle that it is morally wrong to impose restrictions and costs on peaceful and honest human action. So first of all, law and policy require a proper ethical foundation. If we legalize all acts without harmed victims, then security could focus on theft and violence, greatly reducing crime and the cost of law enforcement. The second thing wrong with public policy is that public finance today violates the economic laws of prosperity. Taxes don't just take money from people and transfer the funds to the government. Taxes on income or sales have to be added to the cost of production. By raising prices and squashing incentives, such taxes reduce the amount of production and investment, and that creates what economists call an excess burden. This is a colossal misallocation and waste of resources. So how can government get revenue without an excess burden? First of all, we should reduce the need or desire for state revenue, eliminate counterproductive programs. Ending the war on drugs, for example, could save over $1 billion a year in California. Secondly, either privatize state programs or, where feasible, charge user fees. Parks, highways, even security can be financed by fees from users. Schooling takes up a third of the California government spending. People pay tuition for private schools. Why not also for government schools? Third, collect restitution payments from people who cause damage. Polluters, for example, should compensate society for the harm they cause. Fourth, if taxes there must be, they should at least be levied on items which do not shrink, hide, or flee when taxed. The excess burden occurs because production shrinks when taxed, or it hides underground, or it flees to other places. So what is there that does not hide, shrink, or flee when tapped for revenue? What do you think? The answer is right under our feet. It's land, territory, space, and location. Land is here by nature. Can we import land? No. Can we manufacture more square miles of space? No. Space may be the final fiscal frontier. But tapping it is an ancient idea. It was described in the 1700s by the French free trade economists who call themselves physiocrats. They're the ones who gave us the term laissez-faire. Right? The three-dimensional space within this room cannot be destroyed, cannot run away, cannot hide. The rent of space is the natural, efficient, and equitable source of general revenue for public civic goods. Why is it equitable? Because of the phenomenon called capitalization. Consider two neighborhoods. I'll call them Muscle Town and Skeletonville. Muscle Town has beautiful parks, excellent security, no crime, well-paved streets, recreation including big swimming pools, and fantastic fireworks on the 4th of July. Skeletonville has no parks, poor security, high crime, streets with potholes, cracked pavements, no recreational facilities, no fireworks. Now suppose your choice is which community to rent a house in, and the rent is the same, and everything else is equal. Where would you rather live? And how many would rather rent a house in Skeletonville? Nobody. How many in Muscletown? Okay. So since most would rather live in Muscletown, the rent of real estate would not stay the same. The greater demand to live in Muscletown would raise the rent there, so the price of real estate, specifically the land value, would rise as well. So the better services of Muscletown get capitalized into higher rents and land values. Now, there's an unfortunate doctrine in economics called market failure, which Peter also referred to. For public goods, this doctrine says that markets fail because many folks want to be free riders. The market failure doctrine says that once a public good like security or streets that cannot be conveniently fenced are made available, there's no practical way to charge people. Therefore, says this doctrine, government must provide the service via taxation. Government must force everybody to pay. What this false doctrine overlooks is that the public goods typically provided by government do not exist out in the ether, like some books would have you think, but rather in physical three-dimensional space, like in Muscletown. To live and work in that space and location, people must pay rent, whether to a landlord or by buying land. So the most common users of public goods, such as security and streets, are not free riders because they have to pay rent to be located where the goods are. If the goods are paid for by taxation on wages, then a worker tenant gets double billed. First, he has to pay taxes, and then secondly, he has to pay the higher rent due to the goods. He gets double billed. I say that's not equitable. But when that rent generated by the civic goods is in turn used to pay for these goods, then there's no double payment. That's why the use of rent for public services is equitable in addition to being efficient. Now you might be wondering why, if rent is the efficient and equitable source of government revenue, why is government not using rent today and instead taxing sales, income, and construction? I was counting the dimensions of how government today is so messed up. The first dimension is with ethics. The second is with economics. The third is our structure of government. The way we elect governments today is with mass democracy. Thousands and millions of people are voting this year for candidates whom they don't even know. These candidates need thousands and millions of dollars to send their message out and their image out via the mass media such as television. This demand is supplied to a large extent by special interests. The branch of economics that studies this is called public choice. The key concept is concentrated interests and spread out costs. Special interests such as unions and big farmers have an incentive to lobby for favors because they get a large gain per person. The cost of each subsidy is thinly spread among the taxpayers and consumers in general. So they have little incentive to know better about this and oppose it. Economists call the seeking of subsidies and favors rent seeking, economic rent being any surplus gain, although a better term, I think, is transfer seeking. Greedy transfer seeking, which exploits public ignorance, is the reason why the law does not conform with liberty, why there are taxes that impose an excess burden, why out-of-control government spending has led to today's fiscal crisis. So, what are the effective remedies? The most effective remedy is to transform government into networks of private communities. My chapter in The Voluntary City is on proprietary communities and community associations. A proprietary community is like a hotel or apartment house, having a single owner and providing housing and public services to tenants. A hotel, as we heard already, is a private community that operates in the market. The customers pay voluntarily, unlike taxation. The payment is efficient, unlike today's taxes. When you use a hotel elevator, do you get nickel and dimed? No. The use of the vertical transit is gratis. So how is it paid for? From the room charge. The public services of the hotel, the lobby, the escalators and elevators, the corridors, recreation, fire safety, security, all of these are paid from the room rental. There's no added cost to use the facilities and therefore no excess burden. Now, the Independent Institute has charged you one fee for admission. In effect, you are paying rent to be located here. But notice that the Independent Institute does not add a surcharge to the books it's selling, at least I hope not. If they did, they would sell fewer books, and that would be inefficient. So the Independent Institute does not get revenue that way. Yet that is precisely how government imposes taxation. Condominiums and residential associations also use efficient public financing. The owner of a unit pays a monthly assessment, unrelated to his personal income, purchases, or possessions. Again, no excess burden. In effect, the hotel guest or condominium unit owner is efficiently and equitably paying a site rental or land rent. Markets select for efficiency, unlike governments that impose needless costs. So we could solve the fiscal problems of state and local governments by privatizing governance itself, shift services to private communities, paid for by user fees, rentals, and fines. Now, realistically, this is not going to happen soon. But the ideal solution is very important for policy today because it points to the direction of effective reform. It points to the direction that effective reform needs to take. We should move in the direction of legalizing, decentralizing, privatizing, downsizing, and physiocratizing. So to sum up, our city problems such as crime, pollution, poverty, and congestion all occur because we're not following the laws of ethics and economics that create liberty and prosperity. Sound public finance would not just bring revenue, it would also solve social problems. Untaxing labor raises wages and reduces poverty. Untaxing capital creates more and better jobs. Restitution for negatives like pollution reduces that problem. Private transit and tolls reduce congestion. So privatizing or at least decentralizing governance will reduce transfer seeking and provide more effective services such as better security. A truly voluntary city would be made up of associations and networks of consensual communities. They would provide abundant public services because that would increase the rent and so it would benefit the owners as well as the tenants, guests, and customers. Private communities create market success. Thank you, I'm done.
One thing I might just throw out, which we can touch on during the Q&A period, is it gets back to something that Peter was alluding to, was, of course, in the situation with the California state deficit during the transition period. Incoming Governor Schwarzenegger had an audit done of the state. And as most of us know, when an audit is done, that includes a balance sheet and an income statement. For some reason, a balance sheet was not included. There's no audit of actual state assets. If you actually go to General Services, you'll find out that, and other aspects of the state government, you'll find out there is no inclusion of major assets that the state of California owns or they're valued at acquisition level. In fact, you can't even get a total report. If you want to go to General Services and get a report of total land that the state owns, you have to know what lands to ask for. So it's an interesting situation in which you have a fiscal crisis, and yet most organizations, when they have a fiscal crisis, one of the first things they think about is what kind of assets can they liquidate to get cash now, and that seems to be off the table. Our next speaker is Daniel Klein, who is Associate Professor of Economics and General Director of the Civil Society Institute at Santa Clara University. He received his PhD in economics from New York University. He's been a visiting fellow in the Social Philosophy and Policy Center at Bowling Green State University. He's been a visiting scholar at the City University of Stockholm, assistant professor of economics at the University of California at Irvine, visiting scholar in economics at Stanford University. He's also a contributing author to The Voluntary City. He's also been a contributor to our journal, The Independent Review. He's also co-editor of one of the Institute's websites, which is called fdareview.org, which I, of course, would recommend anyone who's interested in health issues, especially pertaining to FDA policies. His books include Curb Rights, What Do Economists Contribute, Reputation, A Plea to Economists Who Favor Liberty, and Three Libertarian Essays. Dan has contributed to many journals, and I'm delighted to introduce him. Dan is going to use the overhead projector and the microphone here. So,
hi everybody. I have a couple of slides which I didn't get to turn into a handout. They're kind of just my lecture notes, which you can read on with. I just have five of them. I wanted to thank David first of all for having us tonight and organizing these wonderful events, and for running a whole organization that makes these wonderful products. I think this one's really an exceptionally outstanding one, and it's not because I'm in it that I say that. This project actually is quite old. David Beto, the first editor listed, was planning this collection probably at least 10 years ago and talking about it and beginning to put together a group of papers to put together, and he ran into all sorts of troubles doing it. He also ran into some personal academic troubles. He's fine now, and he's landed on his feet, but sometimes academia does funny things to people. But anyway, during those troubled years, I think Peter kind of took it over and really saved this project, so I'm really grateful to Peter as well as somebody who absolutely made the difference in this project coming together. Alex Tabarrok is Independent Institute's own and very actively involved himself in the editing and perfecting of this book. So thank you guys. As David mentioned, my chapter is about private roads, private toll roads that were common throughout 19th century America. And before getting a little bit into that history and the themes there, I thought I'd say a little bit about Adam Smith, because it relates to this theme of civil society that Peter emphasized. Smith is most famous for his 1776 book, The Wealth of Nations, where he really beautifully developed the theory of the market and market mechanisms and how each person pursuing their own interests tends to actually promote the interest of society at large. People don't know so much about his earlier book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments. And in that book, he dealt entirely about these feelings of reciprocity and esteem and sympathy and how those mechanisms work in society. It's got nothing to do with market mechanisms. He really began as an economist late in life. He was first a moral philosopher. In fact, his first job was as a rhetoric teacher. And I thought I'd say a little bit about his first book, because it has the same character and flavor of his more famous book, which is to say that he actually has a strong view in this book as well about an invisible hand, seeing as though an invisible hand makes things work out well when things are voluntary. His term was sympathy, and what he meant by that was that our sentiments were sort of coordinated to each other, and we were sort of aware of our sentiments being coordinated. So in a sense, they were both of ours at the same time. And that was the sort of cornerstone of his book. Esteem is like love. It implies a sort of reflectivity, or it's a kind of equilibrium in a kind of coordination game we play. And when we get there, we feel good about it. We're like relating to each other, or we're communing with each other. In esteem, souls look affectionately on each other. Hence, esteem is not merely fame, notoriety, attention, or praise. In the extreme case of differential accomplishments, the hero at least esteems the admirer for appreciating that he, the hero, is worthy of esteem. Like, at least you appreciate the sort of larger, the thing larger than me that the hero is actually serving or being motivated by. And in that common appreciation, they esteem each other. Smith saw that people value this kind of coordinated sentiment like they value food in their stomach. He posited at the outset that people are other-regarding. Just like Peter said, sometimes economists get accused of thinking that people are selfish, but that's generally not true, or at least it's not good of the good economists. It's a given that everybody is, you know, you're Californians, you're Oaklanders, you're Americans, and we know what they're like. They are other-regarding. They do care about esteem. You do appreciate people, and you do appreciate being appreciated. He explained that people are motivated by esteem, and that society works by esteem mechanisms as well as market mechanisms. And an important part of all this is what's inside of us. We study and idolize figures, like I've studied my master Peter Gordon when I was younger, that we especially admire and esteem, that edify our deeper levels of esteem, and we kind of imagine the would-be esteem from our friends and idols. Like maybe I like to think that Adam Smith would smile at what I do. Like some people are happy that maybe Christ would smile at what they do. We develop the impartial spectator, that's Smith's term, on the cornerstone of imagined or phantom esteem. Thus, esteem can be said to include self-esteem, that sort of internalized esteem, personal honor or conscience. So this book really is very much about two kinds of mechanisms, as the subtitle of the book indicates. First, there's the market mechanisms, which we have pretty darn good theories of. I have to say. And by the market mechanism, when people want X, that creates profit opportunities in terms of dollars and cents. And then the discovery of those profit opportunities by entrepreneurs who supply X and sell it to the people who want it, satisfying the demand for X. So the demand for X, toothpaste, creates opportunities for profit. Entrepreneurs discover that opportunity, they supply toothpaste, they make profits by doing it. It's a nice system. It works out well. That was the main topic of Smith's 1776 book. But there's also the esteem mechanisms and the want of X in this case, create social awareness of the problem of supplying X. Sometimes there's difficulties and challenges to supplying X. Sometimes the market mechanisms won't work so well, and those are special challenges. But awareness of that creates esteem opportunities. And then there's discovery of these opportunities. Leaders, heroes, good neighbors, citizens, nonetheless, do what they can to supply X, reaping, as it were, esteem as their reward instead of profits, and satisfying the initial demands for X. So there's esteem mechanisms as well as market mechanisms. That was really what Smith was talking about in the first book, and that's what we see, you know, just like you use the expression proof by existence. Was that it? And we see this in action. I mean, we see a lot of voluntary charity, a lot of voluntary action, even when there's not money and dollars and cents profit in it. So my chapter is about the thousands of private toll roads that were constructed in the 19th century. People paid for these by chipping in money. Now, these contributions to the toll road company took the form of stock purchases, which on paper, looking back, if you just read the legal script, you might think was about, well, gee, I'm buying stock in this company and hoping that I'm going to get dividends from the toll revenues. But when you go back and read the social history and you read the promotion and the newspaper campaigns and people's diaries and the correspondence, you find out that, in fact, most of these companies did not make any profits. And for the most part, people knew this going into it. Now, if there's not going to be dividends, why are you buying stock? And the answer, at least for a lot of the turnpikes, you know, maybe half of these thousands of turnpikes, was that people saw it basically as community enterprise of providing a local service. And they did this for all sorts of reasons. It was in the interest of the community to have better highways. It would improve transportation. It would improve land values, which gets back to the territorial issues that Fred's work focuses on. But still, you know, it's even though it would be good for the community, it's not as though one person's contribution to the local highway project would probably make a difference. So if someone really wanted to be unpleasant and a bad neighbor, they probably could not participate and then reap the benefits of the good road that their neighbors actually coughed up for. But by and large, you know, that problem was overcome. And they overcame it, as my article talks about, through a whole set of mechanisms, deploying these esteem mechanisms or capitalizing on them. All sorts of private meetings, beginning at first with the people who would have the strongest interest in the project. Publicly announced meetings, including town meetings, famous New England town meetings, we're talking about the 1830s, and they'd say, we should have this road, it's good for the country, now who's going to contribute? Put up your hand. And they took public pledges so that people appreciated each other and also put social suasion on each other. Correspondence, we've a lot of interesting correspondence, formation of associations and clubs, door-to-door solicitations, an affiliation of other organs of social capital, such as churches, getting their leaders to say, you should be doing your part in this. It's not right of you to benefit from this community project and not do your share, not pull your weight. And we saw also mixing of esteem and market mechanisms in all sorts of interesting ways. So in terms of proof by existence that voluntary methods work, even when there's not real profit in it, I'm going to show you some numbers. These first numbers are just some math that I did about the percent of money, the percent of 1830 GDP that went into these states' private toll road projects from the 1830 GDP, and that adds up to 6.5%. And then if you compare that to the money that went in over 40 years to the interstate highway system, which is a big famous highway period and movement in this country, but governmentally financed through taxes,
and which is heralded as this great, you know, road construction event. In fact, that was less per capita in terms of 1995 GDP than what people contributed voluntarily for this period's highway construction. These highways existed and were built throughout the country. This is a little table. A lot of the data is very incomplete here, and we're estimating in some cases, but I've circled the key things here. In terms of roads, private roads actually built and operated, there were between 2,500 and 3,200 private roads in this country, toll roads. And altogether, these were operating combined mileage of 30 to 52,000 miles. So again, it's a big example of proof that this can work by existence. In fact, the historians of 19th century highway construction really say that basically it was a private enterprise success. It was not done much by government at all. The State Department of Highways were only getting started by 1900. The federal involvement in highway construction was minimal, and I could read to you quote after quote from the counties around California of county historians back in old books saying, you know, when the going got tough, people used private enterprise to build roads and build their infrastructure. They did not expect it from the local government or any other government they could hope to turn to. So it can work. It's not just about markets and profits. It's also about community and knowing each other and esteem and meaning and the experience. And that's an important point that often gets overlooked, is that, you know, building a highway, building a park, it's not really just about, well, gee, this is a convenient and lovely park for me to sit in. It's also partly about, you know, how did we get this park? Like, am I part of where this came from? Or am I part of, you know, the process that provided this park? That's a big part of people's well-being as well. You know, the meaning of the goods, not just the usage of the goods. So providing these goods is also, I think, a very significant part of what we do and what we want to do with our lives. And I think that the process of doing it through voluntary means, of asking people to contribute, appealing to their generosity, showing real gratitude when they voluntarily make a sacrifice for you, is a lot more meaningful. It generates a lot more esteem than the governmental approach, which is that politicos decide that there should be renovations in the park or an extension of the highway, and then they start lobbying the legislature for money to extract it anonymously and coercively from taxpayers. I mean, we want the story of our lives to be a good story, not just to have a comfortable park to sit in. And I think that the voluntary story is a much better story to live than the governmental story. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan.